Welcome to The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in. We're on Twitter at KUOW. The Seattle Times is calling it Shamilton. At least eight people conned by a thief who allegedly burgled a Seattle theater, made off with blank tickets, printed up fake tickets to the hottest show in town, and ripped people off using Craigslist and other resale sites. According to the SPD blotter, quote, police discovered the suspect was trying to sell tickets to a well-known rapsicle. That's a rap musical. The suspect trying to sell tickets to a well-known rapsicle about a guy who wasn't president and arrested him in a grocery store parking lot shortly after he tried to pawn a few tickets off on an unsuspecting victim. My next guest is putting Hamilton on stage at Seattle's Paramount Theater. Josh LaBelle is executive director of Seattle Theater Group. Welcome, Josh.
Thank you, Bill. We're honored to be on the air here with you.
You first spotted the fake tickets and called the cops. How did you figure it out?
Well, they look different than the current tickets we're using, so that was very easy.
So these at least eight people who show up with fake tickets at the Paramount Theater for Hamilton, what happened to those folks? They just get turned out in the cold?
No, of course not. We will always do our best for our patrons, try to get them into the performance that they have fraudulent tickets for, and if we're unable to get them into that performance, we'll do our best to get them into a future performance. We have what we call trouble seats for situations like this, but in this situation, there was an awful lot of tickets. I believe six showed up last Tuesday night, a couple more over the weekend.
How much did they pay for the fake tickets?
I don't have that information.
All right. Well, shame on the person who. Do we know what it was like? Was it an inside job? Do we know anything about the crime?
It was not an inside job. Seattle Theater Group employees or contractors had nothing to do with this. My understanding, and again, this is, I didn't speak directly with the police, but my understanding that the person that, you know, has been arrested, who's in jail, also confessed to breaking into the Neptune Theater several years ago, in which our ATM machine was robbed, as well as a few computers and some ticket inventory.
What did those guests say when they realized they had fake Hamilton tickets?
Well, I'm sure they were horrified. I don't know what they said. I wasn't there on site at the incident itself, but rest assured, I have every reason to believe that they felt that our staff did everything we can to take care of them and help cure this for them. But I also want to make sure that people listening understand that if you are going to buy tickets to any event, I'm not just talking about Hamilton, to any event on the secondary market, please do not use cash.
Why not?
There is risk involved. There are people, clearly, that are using the secondary market to commit fraud. And if you use it on your credit card, if you pay for tickets on your credit card, at least you could reverse those charges. If you use cash, I don't know how you wind up getting that money back.
Well, let's talk about the secondary ticket market. The police say this guy resold those fake tickets on Craigslist and other sites. You told the Seattle Times you hate the secondary ticket market, wish it was illegal in our state. What's wrong with legally reselling genuine, not counterfeit, Hamilton tickets?
I just think there's too much downside that is happening in the arts and cultural space. And I think also what winds up happening is tickets are artificially increased in pricing.
What do you mean artificially? If someone will pay it, what's artificial about it?
Well, let's put it another way, Bill. You know, 2 years ago, we passed a law outlawing bots, the use of bots in our state.
Bots being the computer programs that suck up all the tickets.
Yeah, computer creepy crawlies that get in front of patrons, suck up all the tickets, and then put the tickets onto different sites for resale at a much higher price. What winds up happening is people feel frustrated. They really want to go see certain shows, and they wind up paying more than the original intended ticket price. I think that is not healthy for our arts and cultural community. It increases the price for individuals and families to see things, and it makes it harder for them to see multiple things time and time again. If you have to go spend $500 to go see something, isn't it going to be harder on you to go see the next thing? Aren't you going to have to wait a bit longer? I think arts and culture need to be accessible for all, access for all.
Do you think Washington State will outlaw the secondary ticket market? Does that happen in other states?
I don't think they will, no. No, but what I want the listeners to understand is that people who are doing things illegally on the secondary market are now going to be caught. And, you know, if anyone out there is a bot user, here's your warning. You're going to get caught.
Josh LaBelle, executive director at the Seattle Theater Group. They run the Paramount and the Moore and the Neptune. Hamilton is playing at the Paramount through March 18th. Josh, are there any tickets left?
Yes. We have approximately 40 tickets for most shows that are set aside for a lottery at $10 a piece. That's a clear way of getting tickets, great seats, safely for $10 only. And from time to time, the theater is releasing a few seats back into the market. Come to our box office. That's a good, safe place to go, or stgpresents.org.
Josh LaBelle, Seattle Theater Group, thanks for this.
Thank you so much.
Pardon me, are you Aaron Burr, sir?
That depends. Who's asking?
Oh, well, sure, sir.
Thank you for tuning into The Record on KUOW. The Puget Sound area is booming with nowhere to boom. We can't sprawl into the desert like we're Phoenix. We're hemmed in by water. Bremerton had an answer last year. They launched a fast ferry. And how's that working out? KUOW's Region of Boom reporter Carolyn Adolph is here to tell you. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi.
What was the dream of the fast ferry service?
Well, that Bremerton and Kitsap County could become Seattle's western frontier.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that we could...
The western expansion.
Exactly, the western expansion.
Over the waves.
Yes, because, let's say it, the road system is never going to get any better because we keep adding people. It doesn't matter that we're adding on other forms of transit like light rail. We're always going to be stuck with a road system design in the 50s and 60s, and that's the way of it. So the other thing that's been going on is the cost of living over here. That's become a problem. But Bremerton has been held back by the fact that the ferry was an hour in length, which amounts to an hour and a half, you know, with all the standing around before and after.
All the rigmarole.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So the dream was that a half-hour fast ferry would make it just as interesting to live in Bremerton as it would be to live in Edmonds. So that's the whole idea, a half-hour fast ferry. Yeah, you charge people a little bit more to use it, but that speed would create a sort of a lifestyle there, a ferry to and walking lifestyle that would be agreeable to people.
Yes, and how's that working out, Carolyn?
It's not there yet. It's not there yet because, you know, the dream hasn't been fully realized because there's been problems with the fast ferry itself. The reservation system's a little bit on the Byzantine side, and it really forces people to engage with it all the time. You got to drop everything the moment a reservation window opens up, and then it's a dog-eat-dog fight for reservations so that you have a guarantee that this boat is going to work for you.
Right. That's still rigmarole.
Still rigmarole. And the other thing is, so people, like, they say they want the service and they need it, but they're unhappy. One of the reasons they've been unhappy is because of the reliability of the vessel itself. A lot of that cleared up, but it's still a problem for them.
What's the biggest problem they're having?
It boils down to this. Kitsap Transit launched a brand new service with a used boat and no backup.
Hmm.
So at first the boat kept breaking down. It was 128 missed sailings from July when they started the service to October. And while they were in the engine room trying to find out what the heck was wrong with the thing.
I'm seeing you're making motions like they're throwing wrenches around or something. Yeah, okay. they're troubleshooting.
This is, yes. They're troubleshooting and they discover, basically these engines can't cut it. They were never meant to be used as intensely as you have to use a ferry. And so they have to replace them.
They have to replace them.
They have to replace them. They have to haul them into dry dock, get the whole thing out of the water, and yank out the guts.
And they don't have a spare.
Ta-da!
So that's, what are they going to do? Cancel the service?
Well, maybe not. There's a boat that's supposed to, that's qualified to do the job, which is saying something because there are these restrictions on the kind of a fast ferry that you can operate in Rich Passage, all those shoreline erosion issues. Mm-hmm. Anyway, the thing is, the boat with this qualification is the Spirit of Kingston, and Kitsap Transit does not own it. It's owned by King County. It's King County's spare for its water taxi service.
Okay, so King County's got a spare. What's the problem with borrowing the spare for you know, for a few weeks when needed?
Well, it's a lot more than asking a neighbor for a cup of sugar. Oh. I mean, the Kitsap Ferry's going to be down for a few weeks, right? And the repairs could go out longer than usual. It wouldn't be the first time it's happened, right? And King County is saying, hey, all right, we can do a deal here. But if we need it because we have a water taxi breakdown, hey,
still our boat.
9/10 of the law. It's our boat, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
So this is the thing. I mean, there's this question mark hanging over the service for early spring, March to April. In that period, how's it going to actually go?
So what about the fact that, as we said, this ferry was supposed to be part of the Bremerton boom? Mm. How's the Bremerton boom coming? You reported on this last year.
Yes, when I was there last week, I saw more shops closed and more turnover in the downtown than I had observed before when I was there in June. I did consult a real estate expert while I was there, and he said that there is a small real estate boom right in that walking distance area to the ferry. So that indicates that some people are betting on this matter being solved and that eventually there will be a reliable service. And there is some good news there, Bill. There's going to be two new ferries bought at a cost of $17 million to Kitsap Transit. So within a year or two, we should be in a position where there are a couple of ferries running and there's a spare.
Okay. KUOW's Region of Boom reporter Carolyn Adolph telling you about the expansive dreams and the complicated reality of the Bremerton Fast Ferry Service. Carolyn, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
This is The Record, back in a moment on KUOW. It's KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. I'm Bill Radke. An $81 million preschool system that Seattle voters approved in 2014 is showing mixed results. Outside evaluations find that the Seattle preschool program is faring poorly on instructional quality. But as Ann Dornfeld reports from KUOW's race and equity team, experts say that was predictable.
Annie Sherritt voted for the Seattle preschool program, and when her oldest daughter turned four, she quickly enrolled her.
It was the most amount of preschool we could get for the least amount of money.
For 6 hours a day, 5 days a week, they pay just $550 a month. Full-time private preschool can cost four times that much. And Sherritt says her daughter seems really happy in the program.
She loves to be a lights helper and turn off all the lights in our house, which is a rule from preschool. She likes to pretend to be a teacher and teach her little sister, so that part's been really great.
But Sherritt has some concerns. She says she'd hoped for the program to be more focused on children's individual interests rather than rote academic skills.
Every single day, she comes home with a sample of her having traced her name at school. I think it's great that she has learned how to write her name and is getting experience with writing and letters, but it just seems like quite a focus on that particular skill.
When Seattle Mayor Ed Murray pitched his subsidized preschool program to voters in 2014, this was his promise. High-quality, affordable early learning that would help bridge the opportunity gap between children rich and poor, black and white.
We now have decades of study that show if someone gets quality universal pre-K, it changes their performance in school for the better.
Tuition is free for families making up to 300% of the federal poverty level and sliding scale for higher-earning families. But 3 years into the four-year pilot, the quality of the program appears decidedly mixed. Annual outside evaluations have found that its teachers provide warm, loving environments for children. But evaluators found that the quality of instruction tended to be low. On two different assessments of quality, evaluators found that teachers were not doing enough to support children's learning in areas like language and vocabulary, basic math skills, and problem solving.
I'm not surprised that in getting off of the ground and getting things going for the first few years, the quality isn't yet where we would hope to see it.
Education researcher and writer Suzanne Bouffard is the author of the recent book, The Most Important Year, Pre-Kindergarten and the Future of Our Children. She studied how public preschool programs are doing across the country.
In general, the research that we have over the last decade or so shows that quality tends to be pretty mediocre.
Where programs are excelling, Bouffard says, in places like Boston and New Jersey, that's come after they've been up and running for years. Boston achieved its major gains when it stopped its rapid expansion and focused on improving things like curriculum and teacher training. Seattle, meanwhile, has grown from 15 classrooms initially to at least five times that number this coming fall. Bouffard says it is possible to grow and meet quality goals.
You would hope in some ways that we could learn the lessons of those initiatives and get to quality faster. But at the same time, we have learned that going to scale with quality and creating really great programs for everyone is a challenge.
A major lesson, experts agree, is the need for extensive teacher training. Teaching preschool has traditionally been a low-paid job that didn't require a lot of education. The Seattle Preschool Program includes both new classrooms created in public schools and community centers and existing preschools. The existing preschools that have joined the program are typically in lower-income neighborhoods. In past years, they weren't able to charge enough tuition to afford the kind of ongoing training teachers need to meet evolving expectations.
I think there are a lot of programs that have done a beautiful job preparing children to be happy, healthy, socially, emotionally stable children, but never had to focus so much on the skill development necessarily.
Monica Liang Aguirre is the city's early learning director and oversees the preschool program. She says they give teachers a lot of coaching to get them up to speed.
We started off with a standardized approach for all teachers, and we realized that we have teachers at different levels, so some teachers might need much more intensive support.
Liang Aguirre says that coaching is paying off. In the preschool program's second year, evaluators found that teachers had gotten better at making books engaging for kids, weaving math lessons into other activities, and spending more time one-on-one with children to individualize their learning. Sherelle Butler has taught young children for 18 years. She's now with a launch preschool in Madrona. She says her coach is helping her with things like behavioral approaches, teaching kids to problem solve, and letting children guide the lessons.
After you've been doing it so long, you find yourself getting stuck in the same rut of, okay, it's February, we're going to do Valentine's, but breaking out of that and really figuring out what the kids are interested in and what they want to do, and then making your lesson plans reflect that.
So how much are kids learning in the Seattle preschool program? City officials point to student test results that suggest low-income kids and children of color are making the greatest academic gains. But they warn it's hard to gauge the impact of the program this early on. Early childhood expert Suzanne Bouffard says assessment results for little kids should be taken with a grain of salt.
Because we know from research that standardized test scores are unreliable in young children for a variety of reasons. One is just, you know, if you think about any preschooler that you know, they can be in a completely different mental place from one day to the next.
Another issue is that it's hard to distinguish how much preschoolers are building particular skills at school versus at home. The most scientific way to determine the success of a preschool program is through a randomized, controlled study that follows children for years. That's something the Seattle Preschool Program didn't do. At the Department of Education and Early Learning, Monica Liang Aguirre points to a quality measure where the preschool program is thriving: teachers' approaches to building social-emotional skills.
Preschool is an opportunity for children to establish themselves as learners, as a person, and as a part of a community. And we absolutely prioritize and value the social-emotional support that a preschool classroom provides.
The pilot program enters its final year this fall. Meanwhile, city leaders plan to ask voters for more money to continue the preschool program and expand it even further.
You know, the challenge that I see moving forward is how can we bring this to scale, right? How can we make this accessible across the city?
Liang Aguirre says they're working with new mayor Jenny Durkin to decide what the next phase of the preschool program would look like. A renewal levy may be on Seattle ballots as early as this November. I'm Ann Dornfeld, KUOW News.
And we have Ann Dornfeld with us for a couple of more questions. Ann, thank you for this.
My pleasure.
You said in that piece that Seattle's preschool program gets low marks for instruction, language, math, problem solving, but high marks for social emotional skills. Well, a lot of parents want preschool to focus on social emotional development. Is that a bad thing?
No, not at all. I mean, I'm a preschool parent, and I definitely want that for my child, too. And when we talk about academics at the preschool level, I think it can be misleading because a lot of folks are thinking flashcards or their kids sitting in little rows and getting drilled to counting to 100 or something like that. But what evaluators are really looking for at the Seattle preschool program are things like teachers using new words and building kids' vocabulary or teaching critical thinking skills that can help kids be, you know, really kind of savvy consumers of television or choices they're making in their friendships, or taking the opportunity when a kid points out the new buds on the cherry trees to talk about how plant growth cycles work. I think what can get lost for a lot of highly educated, well-resourced parents in Seattle is how much their children get these things at home.
That's a good point.
That's not always true for kids for low-income families. And it's a way that preschool can really prepare children for a lifetime of learning right from the jump off. And that was the promise of the preschool program.
So Mayor Durkan is going to decide, as you said, on the next phase. How could she change the Seattle preschool program that might make it more effective?
Well, from the public programs I looked at in other cities and states, Boston seems to have a lesson for Seattle in the way that it really paused its growth and focused on improving quality before it scaled way up. Seattle actually looked at Boston as one of the programs that it was modeling its own preschool program after. There's some differences, but that's one that Seattle has looked at. And I did talk to education researcher Suzanne Bouffard about that, who we heard from in my story, and she says that the thing is the public can be really impatient and that investing more money in a program that's not actively growing can be a tough sell for voters. So that may be something that would happen in Seattle, too.
KUOW reporter Ann Dornfeld telling you about the possibilities for the Seattle preschool program. Thanks, Ann.
Anytime.
It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. We'll be back in a moment. I'm Bill Radke. There are reasons a rape victim might not immediately press charges. We've talked about those reasons on this show. They might be traumatized. They might face retaliation. They might not be believed. Trials can be exhausting, expensive, humiliating. In Washington State, you cannot wait forever to press charges for rape and sexual assault. There is a statute of limitations. Sometimes a victim has 10 years to press charges. Sometimes it's only 3 years. My next guest says we should have no statute of limitations for rape and the most serious sexual assaults. State Representative Dan Griffey is a Republican from Shelton on the Kitsap Peninsula. Welcome, Representative.
Well, thank you so much.
I'm sorry to understand that this is personal for you. What got you involved in sexual assault law?
Well, it really originally started with my wife and her miserable treatment by her stepfather. And we talked about that for years, but I have another thing that I don't talk about, and I just got recent permission to talk about it. My daughter went to Alaska to work at a fishing cannery, and she was on her way to cash her check. After she cashed her check, she had cash. She was thrown alongside the road. They stole her money. They brutally raped her and left her for dead. It's just by the grace of God that my daughter made it home to us. It's time the monsters actually have to look over their shoulder the rest of their natural lives and wonder if evidence can be brought forward to make sure that they pay on this good earth for the monstrous things they do.
Representative, thank you for sharing that with us. I'm sorry to hear that, of course. In your experience, what has the statute of limitations meant?
So I think the biggest thing that means is it doesn't respect the damage that has been done to the survivors. The damage is lifelong, and I say it's akin to murder. We have no statute of limitations on murder. And unfortunately, I think what we do is we, the people that commit these crimes, they murder a little piece of that person, a little piece of their soul. They're not the same person. They have to look over their shoulder the rest of their lives. With the current law as it is, there's a time frame. There's an expiration date. People get to be able to do cartwheels. Look at me. I survived. I now can't be prosecuted for this terrible, heinous thing that I did. I think it's disrespectful to the survivors. It does not give an adequate respect for the horrendous crime that was committed. All too often right now, there are terrible, let's just say, practices that people that commit these crimes do, be it video recordings of the incident, be it leaving their DNA behind. And when we can get prosecutors and law enforcement those pieces of evidence that can bring them up and prosecute them, I think shouldn't expire.
Again, this is State Representative Dan Griffey, a Republican from Shelton on the Kitsap Peninsula, sponsoring a bill to eliminate the statute of limitations for rape and the most serious sexual assault offenses. There is another side to this issue. Also with us is a Senate leader who has said he will not give this bill a hearing. Law and Justice Committee Chair Jamie Peterson is a Seattle Democrat. Senator, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, I appreciate your coming on talking about this. This is obviously a difficult and emotional issue. You think that we should keep a statute of limitations for these rape and sexual assault offenses, and why is that?
Yeah, so let me say to begin with that I have huge sympathy with the victims of all sexual assault, and in particular the family members of Representative Griffey, and he and I have had a chance to chat about this. I'm absolutely supportive of taking a look at the statutes of limitation and probably extending them. I don't think, for example, that our current law saying that you must report within 1 year, and if you don't, the statute of limitations is only 3 years, is probably adequate. So my intention is that over the interim, we would take a careful look at that and have a variety of experts from the prosecutors to victim advocates to child development experts who might give us some guidance about this and about what other states have done. But we have a very specific procedural problem with the bill as it was drafted in the House, which is that the Senate can't amend House titles, and the House title permits only one answer to the question, which is to completely eliminate all of the statutes of limitation for the named sex crimes. So because I'm not convinced that eliminating the statute of limitations is the right answer, I don't think that this is the best vehicle for us to have this conversation.
Okay. Thank you, Senator. And Representative Griffey, would you be willing to settle for not an elimination but an extended statute of limitations?
Well, at this point in time, I would be willing to support the thousands of survivors that have come forward and told me their horrific stories in improving in any way, shape, or form. With that being said, I really believe that the monsters that commit these horrendous crimes should have to look over their shoulder, should have to worry for the rest of their natural life that their crime may be found. I mean, that is, I think, a core and fundamental thing that we need to do. However, with that being said, I have talked to the good senator, and he said he is unwilling to hear the statute of limitations, eliminating statute of limitations. So a victory for the survivors is what I'm looking for. And if we can get something better, it's just disappointing that we can't at this point in time thoroughly acknowledge that these offenses are so heinous that we as a state would put them on the same level as murder.
Yes, Senator Peterson, there's no statute of limitations on prosecuting a murder. Why should rape or sexual assault be different?
Well, the reason that we single out murder is because the victim is gone, and that's the person who could be the principal witness. So that's why we treat crimes in which someone has died differently from all other crimes. It may give false hope to people who are hoping that these crimes could be prosecuted if they think that after 30 or 40 years, that there's any real likelihood that a prosecutor will be able to muster the evidence to prove beyond somebody's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt.
And this is because so evidence could be contaminated or lost and recollections get hazy? Is that the idea?
Exactly. So we have the reason, a part of the reason that we have statutes of limitation is not so much to protect the accused, although that's not, that is part of it, but it's also to make sure that, people who are victims come forward in a time when it's possible for the prosecutors to get justice for them.
Representative Griffey, is that a problem of false hope for victims of getting their crime prosecuted?
When we first considered the bill, the Prosecutors Association postulated that and posed it as a concern. However, they have now moved to a favorable opinion of eliminating it because of the tendency of these monsters who commit these crimes of keeping evidence. They keep lots of evidence. Usually it's pictures, video recordings, or audio recordings, those sort of things. So since the propensity of them to save the evidence, the prosecutors have changed in their opinion. They believe, while it might be rare, it might be unlikely, they think that they can get evidence to prosecute in the future for old cases. But let me be clear, I would like to empower all the survivors to come forward, give the evidence early, be brave. We're doing lots of things here in Olympia to make sure that we have properly trained nurses at the hospitals, that we have proper notification at the hospitals when a sexual assault nurse is not available, and giving references to where those sexual assault nurses are available. Representative Tina Orwell and myself are trying to get general fund dollars to test the backlog of the sexual assault kits. There's almost 10,000 of them, which is unconscionable. We haven't tested them yet. We are doing things in conjunction with eliminating, and we believe that they are co-occurring things that really should be considered, and we should respect the fact that a little piece of these survivors has perished in the traumatic and horrific event, to say that that forever their victimizers should have to look over their shoulder at very least.
Senator Peterson, would you agree that rape and sexual assault, this is psychologically charged as to be almost in a category by itself when we're talking about sex and violation and violence and sexism and social stigma and retaliation and sometimes child abuse and child trauma? Can you understand all the reasons why the statute of limitations might pose a problem in these cases, that people don't come forward right away?
I absolutely agree that we have good evidence that people may not, for a variety of reasons, come forward immediately. I guess I do want to say, though, I think that there are a lot of crimes that can do, violent crimes that can do significant psychological damage to the victims that don't involve sex, and so I think we need to take a look at this issue sort of holistically.
Are you thinking of?
I think almost any kind of assault and battery, depending on the circumstances, armed robbery. Those are almost all violent crimes that involve human beings as victims. Have the potential to leave psychological scars on people.
Do you accept that, Representative Griffey? Almost any violence can be psychologically scarring.
Well, I do, and there probably are some other areas we have to look at for the statute of limitations, but let me be very clear and frank on this. The neurobiological studies for sexual assault survivors proves beyond a shadow of a doubt the damage, and the damage is horrific and lifelong and life-lasting. We know that the instances of post-traumatic stress are very high in this population, and not always as high in all violent crimes. However, they are there. This one is an outlier, and there's a couple other outliers that I can think of. When you talk about armed robbery, well, I'll tell you what, that somebody should, if we find them, I don't think you recover from that either. You put people's life in jeopardy. But when you're talking about this one specifically, the neurobiological studies show the significant damage, and there are a lot of them out there to prove it.
We've been talking with State Representative Dan Griffey, Republican from Shelton on the Kitsap Peninsula, and Seattle Democrat Senator Jamie Peterson, Chair of the Law and Justice Committee, having the conversation, having the debate about whether Washington State ought to continue to have the statute of limitations that it does when it comes to rape and the most serious sexual assaults. Senator Peterson, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Representative Griffey, again, thank you for sharing the story of your daughter's attack, the rape in Alaska. I think our listeners might be wondering if there's anything you can tell us about how she's doing.
She's a wonderful young mother now. She has an awesome, gave me an awesome son-in-law, and I have a new grandson on the way. And I'm sorry I'm emotional about it, but I just don't understand why people couldn't understand why this crime is so horrific that we should respect the survivors so much that we would change our statutes in the state of Washington for them. And I will not stop until I get it done.
State Representative Dan Griffey of Shelton, thanks again.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW, 94.9 Seattle News and Information, and we'll be back in a moment. It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Let's talk about love. And you know, there's more than one kind of love.
February 14th, Valentine's Day, is about romance. But February 13th, Galentine's Day, is about celebrating lady friends. It's wonderful, and it should be a national holiday. It should be a national holiday. Dear Congress, it's Leslie again.
Happy Galentine's Day. That's Leslie Knope on Parks and Rec, agreeing with my next guest that we are selling ourselves short if we don't see friendship as an important form of love. From NPR's Hidden Brain podcast, producer Raina Cohen, welcome to KUOW.
Thanks so much for having me.
So Valentine's Day does get all the Hallmark attention, but Raina, haven't people always loved their friends too?
I mean, certainly. I think if anything, we probably pay less attention to our friendships than we did before. I mean, if you look centuries back, the kinds of ways people talked about friendship with love and sharing beds with their friends, ways that we talk about only romantic friendship, that's how people thought about friendship for centuries. And I think that we are just not valuing the thing that's been in front of us all along.
How did that happen?
Well, I mean, there's a kind of interesting like history moment, and a lot of things go back to Freud, a lot of unfortunate things. So there's a historian actually out of Washington State named Stephanie Kuntz, and she's looked at how there used to be really close same-sex friendships, but then when you have like the influence of Freudianism, thinking about how same-sex relationships might be kind of deviant or might cause marriages not to progress that well. There is this real push to invest everything in romantic relationships, and that's sort of when dating came around. And, you know, around that time in, like, the mid-20th century, that's really, unfortunately, when romantic love, I think, kind of displaced other forms of love.
And are you seeing a change in this?
Well, I think, I mean, just in the last few years, there have been really wonderful books that, if haven't just been about friendship entirely, devote a key section of it. So the book that I reviewed is called Text Me When You Get Home, and it's about female friendship and trying to elevate this form of relationship that hasn't mattered so much. So I think, you know, just what you're seeing in books, what you're certainly seeing in cultural depictions, I mean, you just played from Parks and Rec. I mean, it was ostensibly a show about this this local government, but it was also about a core female friendship. And then, you know, we see things like Broad City, even like Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. There are these really core female friendships, especially that are at the center. So, you know, maybe we're paying more attention to them, or maybe we're valuing them more. Maybe we're just talking more about the things that have always mattered to us, but for whatever reason, just hasn't been seen as that important. But I do think it's getting better.
Of course, we had Sex and the City celebrating lady friends, except they were awfully focused on the boyfriends in their lives.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's still, though, a show that was centered on the women. I mean, the men kind of came in and out. And I think there's the critic at The New Yorker sort of tried to reimagine how Sex and the City would end if Carrie had not gone after Big and instead had it end on the friendships themselves. So, you know, there are always ways to make these things a little bit better. But I think it's still, like, I've talked to my friends about how I wish we had kind of a core of four people who we went to, you know, have breakfast with on a regular way, which is very much stolen out of Sex and the City. So might have been imperfect and obviously depicted a certain kind of class of women. But there's something to be said for having an image of what you could end up having.
So why would we be appreciating the, and we'll talk about men, I hope, in a moment, but why would we be appreciating the female friendship more than we used to just in the last few years?
I mean, it's a good question. I would think that there's got to be some role in having women in positions where they're able to be the documentarians of our lives and be the ones who are creating the culture that we consume. You know, of course, men can write female characters and can write these sorts of relationships, but I don't think it's a huge surprise that somebody like Shonda Rhimes, you know, is the person who, or Amy Sherman-Palladino, that they're the ones who are showing us what friendship looks like. So I think, yeah, both in journalism and sort of the in arts and like cultural sphere, having more women in those places, I think, gives us a more realistic depiction of what women's lives look like. And they're not just about chasing after men, and that's assuming that they're heterosexual, which is, you know, another assumption that really goes into what kinds of relationships are important and what they should look like.
Well, what about you, Raina? Do you find yourself texting your friends more when you get home, as you said?
I am not a huge texter, but I, with my best friend, we send a lot of voice memos. It's probably a reflection of me being in, working in the audio world, but I definitely have a lot of, sometimes they're like 8-minute long messages with my friend just processing what's happened in her day, and sometimes it's totally mundane, but I definitely have all forms of communication with friends, and it's, I feel lucky that we have ways that we can do this in an instantaneous way.
And are you finding any changes in the male relationships?
So, I mean, in terms of personal expertise, this is, you know,
you should be asking me.
Yeah, well, I mean, you can speak to this, I'm sure, as well as I could. But I'm actually working on an episode with our host right now for Hidden Brain that's about men's and boys' friendships. And I think, you know, we still have this image that boys are maybe just not as interested in close friendships and intimacy as women are and as girls are. But one of the things that really got me interested in this was research that came from an NYU professor named Niobe Way about how boys' friendships change over the course of their adolescence. They talk in ways that are very much like girls about loving their friends, you know, needing that person to keep them from going crazy, and that as they get older and the pressures of what it means to be a man, what it means to be independent, and having some homophobia in the background, that it keeps them from really holding on to those friendships in the same way. So I can only hope that that's going to get better as, you know, in the generations now, that maybe there's a model of what it means to be a sensitive man. But, you know, as we're seeing elsewhere in the news, there's not exactly the best models on that front. But I think it's, you know, it's a really big concern that men aren't as free to be as emotionally expressive and as vulnerable with people of the same sex as I think girls and women are.
Yes, thanks for bringing up generations. Do you find that, let's say, Gen X or baby boomer women, are they immune to these trends, or are you seeing changes in older female friendships too?
Well, I think that that's a pretty underexplored area. You know, I think we do know that social isolation is more common among older people, so that, you know, it's including older women. But, you know, I think that that's a story that needs to be told. But, you know, we can make some guesses that for women who are in their 60s, 70s now, they're more likely to be divorced than in the past, or single, having, you know, never been married. They're probably no longer working, which means that they are not having the kinds of their days are sort of not filled in a very regimented way. And you can certainly imagine how it would be harder to either keep up friendships that were very easy when you were in a workplace, or you know, how it actually could be much more important because you have all these support roles and all this time to fill. And I've certainly seen with the older women in my own life how hard it is when they're older trying to create these relationships when they feel like nobody's going to come out and say that they want them, because there's a sort of air of desperation that comes off, or the sense that, you know, if you're a 60-year-old woman, you should have already had your close circle of friends. What's wrong with you if you haven't? So, you know, I think in a way that the problem really can be elevated for older women.
In fact, I heard, because I listen to Hidden Brain all the time, I heard you discuss how our over-focus on the life partner can come at the expense not only of these old age friendships, if you will, but even at the expense of the marriage itself, that maybe we can chill out on the obsession with romantic love, even among two life partners.
Yeah, I mean, we expect one person to fulfill all sorts of things, and it seems to me to be, like, not just unrealistic, but pretty unhealthy. I mean, if you don't kind of... First, I don't even see how a relationship between two people can be interesting if you're the only two significant people in each other's lives. But, you know, again, it's kind of a historical anomaly that we expect this one romantic partner to take care of everything. And, you know, Stephanie Kuntz, who I mentioned before, had a review in the New York Times this weekend talking about, if you want to have a good marriage, actually, you really should pay attention to your friends, that they are, you know, fulfilling things that otherwise would be a strain on one single other person. And you know, as somebody who is a really big fan of friendship, don't understand why you wouldn't want to include so many wonderful potential people in your life and instead just hone in on one person.
My guest is a big fan of friendship, Raina Cohen, producer on NPR's Hidden Brain podcast. And I understand you forgot about Valentine's Day, but you did celebrate Galentine's Day a couple days ago?
Well, I mean, I made plans to go to a museum talk tomorrow, which I realized was on Valentine's Day when I invited some friends and one had a conflict because of Valentine's Day. But I did have a Galentine's Day breakfast that was very much inspired by reading the book Text Me When You Get Home. Got to learn about the origins of Galentine's Day and thought it was a really good excuse to bring together my female friends all in one place.
And you had more to talk about than just men, your straight women friends.
Yeah, as one
How
of my...
That?
Yeah, well, I think that that's something that maybe people don't recognize, that when women are alone in a room together, they're talking about, you know, trying to save the world and not necessarily just their escapades with men.
I'll try to wrap my head around that. Raina Cohen, producer on NPR's Hidden Brain, which I listen to all the time with host Shankar Vedantam, a celebrator of female friendship, and I hope all kinds of friendship. Raina, thanks a lot for this.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Sure enough. Happy Galentine's Day to you.
And happy Galentine's Day to the women in your life.
It's The Record on KUOW Seattle.
My name is Cupid Valentino, the modern day Cupid. And I just want to say one thing. Happy Valentine's Day. Every day the
14th. That's all for today's show. Our producers are Amina Alsadi, Ajua Jimabrempong, Jason Pagano, Bree Ripley on the tweets. I'm Bill Radke. I hope you'll come back tomorrow for a conversation with Seattle Police Chief Carmen Best. In fact, if you have a question for the chief, Now's your chance. Email us at record@kuow.org. That's record@kuow.org. Or leave us a voicemail, 206-221-3663, 206-221-3663. And we'll put your question to Seattle's interim police chief on tomorrow's show. That's all for today. Thanks for listening. You probably want to hear some more Outkast.